You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Okay, we can get started while he's setting up the mic for the rest of the panelists. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us. Good to know that the unexpected rain didn't deter you from showing up. we have coffees and cookies, so if you haven't gotten some, help yourself and get comfortable. I'm Ibrahima Koulibaly, Senior Fellow in the Global Economy and Development Program here and the Director of the Africa Program. We're here today around this event because some of you, depending on where you fall on the age spectrum, may recall, it wasn't long ago, just a decade and a half, when Africa, among many other countries, benefited from the debt relief initiative. But the continent is in the news again about another possibly systemic debt crisis, similar to the one that necessitated the debt forgiveness. And if that does materialize, then obviously it's going to be a blow to economic development agendas, especially now that it's really hard to mobilize enough financing to meet the sustainable development goals. But the issue is far from settled and not really consensus around the issue. In particular, some point to the fact that the increase in debt, Africa is not unique. It's a global phenomenon, and we've seen that a lot, especially after the global financial crisis, and some of it reflects a counter-cyclical response to be able to stabilize the economies in the face of the shocks the country may have experienced. So the question really is Africa facing another sovereign debt crisis? So we are very fortunate to have a really diverse panel of experts that will help us shed some light on the issue. So beginning with Treng Nguyen, to my left. She's executive director in Emerging Markets Sovereign Credit Strategy at J.P. Morgan in New York. She accumulates over 10 years of experience in emerging market fixed income with a portfolio covering 70 countries. Her team has been recognized among the top three by Institutional Investors Ranking for emerging market sovereign debt for the past 3 years. And by way of disclosure, because I was informed J.P. Morgan funds Brookings, although I haven't seen that money, I still need to share with you that she's speaking in her own capacity and not that of the institution. And then next to her is Vera Songwe. She is Executive Secretary of the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa and a non-resident senior fellow of our Africa program here at Brookings. Previously, Vera was IFC Regional Director covering West and Central Africa and also served as country director for several African countries at the World Bank. She is a member of the Africa Leadership Network and also a member of the African Union Reform Advisory Committee led by President Kagame. And next to Vera is the Honorable Professor Nthuli Nkumbe, who is Minister of Finance and Economic Development in Zimbabwe since September of last year. I think that is important because Zimbabwe is one of the countries in, classified as being in debt distress, and I just want to point out that this preceded his arrival at the helm of the ministry.
Indeed.
And in fact, since he came, he has been
20 years.
He has been quite proactive in trying to address the situation. And as of this morning, we heard from Christine Lagarde that they have just reached a staff-monitored program with the IMF. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Before he became a minister, he also served as chief economist and vice president at the African Development Bank. And in an even earlier life, he was a dean and professor of finance at the Witwatersrand Business School and then dean of the Faculty of Commerce, Law, and Management at the University of Witwatersrand, as well as a lecturer in finance at the London School of Economics. He is chairman of the board of the Africa Economic Research Consortium.
Former
chair of the Africa Research Economic Consortium. He's also a chairman of the Global Agenda Council on Poverty, Economic Development at the World Economic Forum. But that's not former, that is current.
No, that's former as well.
That's also former. Exactly. All right, very good. So then you're free to...
Finance ministers are busy.
there you go. Now you're free to really focus on Zimbabwe.
Yeah, yesterday I was introduced at the bank as incoming executive director.
And yet you're former.
And then last but certainly not least, really, is Shane Nolan. He is Deputy Director of Strategy, Policy, and Review Department at the IMF, where he leads the department's work on low-income countries and on wider development issues, including the 2030 Development Agenda. In relevance to today's discussion, Sean has been leading the IMF's work on debt sustainability frameworks, along with the colleagues at the World Bank. In his prior roles at the IMF, he worked in various departments, including the Africa Department, where he served as a resident representative in South Africa and as deputy director. Before the IMF, he was assistant professor of economics at the Boston University. Okay, so the format basically is that each panelist gets 3 to 5 minutes to provide an opening statement on the question of the agenda. Is Africa facing another systemic debt crisis? You may very well be aware that as economists, we're often accused of never giving a yes or no answer. It's always on the one hand this, and on the other hand that. So let's see if as part of the opening statement and the answer, we can change that perception. Why don't we start with you, Sean. Is Africa facing a systemic debt crisis?
I'm going to avoid the yes-no by changing the question. But in a genuine sense, I think the first thing we have to remember is Africa's a continent, not a sort of a group of homogenous countries, equally so sub-Saharan Africa. And so we're actually not talking, it's nearly dangerous. If we'd sat here in 2011 and talked about this Eurozone debt crisis, we'd have gotten very excited about it. But it turned out to be concentrated in a small subset of countries. So we have to keep that in mind constantly rather than just stick with the broad brush description. And I think the second thought that we need to do in talking about about debt is remember debt's the liability side of the national balance sheet, and we have to remember what's being done with the debt is a key issue, looking on the asset side and on investment for development purposes. This is not to say that labeling something investment means it's got a high rate of return, but it means we're constantly thinking of the balancing act between the two. What I'd like to do briefly is comment on just give you the quick messages from a paper we produced a year ago, which covered all low-income developing countries, which is basically IDA-eligible countries. And what did we learn from that? And we learned a few things. One was debt had risen from about 33% median to about 48% over 4 years, which was quite a rise in quite a short period of time. And the causal factors, civil conflict was one, commodity price stories was another, fiscal expansion was a third, and then governance issues. And this was equally true in sub-Saharan Africa, perhaps more so than in low-income countries elsewhere. A second thing was a number of countries, not merely had debt risen, but more were drifting into high risk of debt distress or just drifting into actual debt distress. The number of sub-Saharan African countries in debt distress rose from 2 in 2013 to 7 in 2018. A third thing we learned, which was a bit troubling for both the bank and ourselves, is that there's an inherent bias in our debt sustainability assessment. There's an optimistic bias. So actually, taking the status quo and the current descriptions as given, there's an embedded optimism bias. Some of it's for good reasons, the optimism bias, because you're kind of assuming the programs you've agreed with governments will be implemented. But sometimes the reasons are not quite as good. They're often of the version that if they do not implement a major fiscal adjustment, they will have a financing crisis, rather than saying they are not going to implement the fiscal adjustment and there will be a financing crisis, which is probably the Ghana 2013-2015 story. The fourth big point that came out of it was the shifting creditor base, one that you've heard an awful lot of. And that was important, not because of different flags and different currencies in which debt has been denominated, but a realization that debt workouts and debt resolution would be much, much more difficult in an environment where we no longer had the Paris Club as the umbrella operation to produce debt restructuring. And we will talk about briefly a number of difficult cases in that regard. And I think the last point to mention was the issue of weak databases, which was true not just of low-income countries, but higher up the spectrum as well, where you had a lot of problems with hidden features to debt, collateralization being a particular one, perimeter issues. You thought you were talking about the general government, but actually no, you were talking about the central government. There was a lot of guarantees and state enterprises and off-budget operations that were missing from your data. And lastly was the contingent liabilities issue, the stuff that came out of the unknown unknowns, to use a famous Washington expression. What's happened since that report is probably the debt levels have, and those median debt levels have continued to drift upwards, particularly if you take into account the optimistic bias. And a few more countries have in sub-Saharan Africa have drifted into debt distress. The Gambia is one. Sao Tome is another. And lastly, since I don't want to be accused of focusing on only one block, we also have issues of debt in emerging market economies in sub-Saharan Africa, of which South Africa and its long-going trend growth in debt is an example, although clearly not a crisis, but an ongoing problem, really a problem of slow growth. And then the dramatic acceleration of debt in Angola, which has resulted in an extensive IMF program. That's, I think, what's happened since then. What are the lessons to be drawn, given that I'm going to actually use a couple of country examples. The lesson we learned from Mozambique is the absolute imperative of having strong governance arrangements governing the contracting of debt. And this is an imperative. And it's near, if you do not have that in place, then you are vulnerable to all sorts of things, including $2 billion in bad loans. We look at the experience of Zambia and of Ghana. It's a classic narrative. It's called spending a lot more money than you're taking in tax, doing it for quite a period of time, often linked to the electoral cycle, and rapid and steadily, but in an ongoing way, accumulating debt, and then ending up, as Ghana did in 2015, in a significant financing crisis. Then there's the lesson of Republic of Congo and Chad. And it sounds initially like a bad luck story of declining oil prices, but of course it's not. The real problem is mismanaging oil price volatility. That's anyone who knows Nigerian history for the late 20th century should have learned this lesson. But we've seen a repeat in both those countries. Spending basically the boom-bust cycle associated with the oil prices. And one last lesson I'd say we've seen, particularly with the Republic of Congo and the Gambia, is debt restructuring in a number of cases has been extremely difficult. In the case of Chad, it was not so difficult because there was only one major creditor who you needed to deal with. In the case of Republic of Congo, there's an IMF arrangement with Congo on hold pending a resolution, a restructuring one particular debt with one particular Chinese bank. But restructuring debts for banks, major entities in China is a new experience. It doesn't happen quickly. And the Gambia is the other example I'd cite where you're in a remarkably diverse set of creditors, various plurilaterals, India, China, the Gulf, etc., and bringing this group of creditors, none of whom has a business model that involves default, bringing them into a room and seeking to negotiate a debt restructuring, which Gambia undoubtedly needs, is truly is an enormous effort, even for a very small country. Let me stop there, actually.
Okay. Right. Thank you. Honorable Nkumbe, what is your take on the issue?
Well, is Africa facing a debt crisis right now? I would say not yet, but I would qualify Zimbabwe as well. I'll get to it. Mm-hmm. But it could face a debt crisis. Now, and this time is different. Why is it different? Because for most countries, the issue is external debt, but it's actually commercial external debt raised from the capital markets mostly, but also commercial debt, which is bilateral commercial debt. Mm-hmm. So you know, after the financial crisis, Africa risk became very interesting. It's still very interesting, by the way. So most countries then decided to go into the market to borrow through the Eurobond market, issuing the debt on the Eurobond market. It's been fantastic, but therein lies a risk in terms mm-hmm. of repayment, especially if the process were used for consumption rather than recurrent expenditure, rather than investment such as infrastructure and so forth. But I think we need to understand what's going on as well. We need to look at the whole debt, the mechanics of the debt accumulation process. There are three things to focus on. One is the interest rate that these countries are paying, including their risk premium. So it's, and then two, the rate of growth in terms of the growth profile. but particularly the gap between the interest rate and the growth projections. And then number three is the primary surplus. So in a situation where there's always a risk of interest rates rising or the risk premium of the country going up relative to the rate of growth of that country, you are at risk of accumulating a debt beyond sustainable level. So that gap between the interest rate and growth is very, very critical. Mm-hmm. So basically the fear then is after the commodity price boom went south, oil prices went south from $100 per barrel, then Africa is at risk of excessive debt accumulation and therefore unsustainable debt. So that's where this narrative is coming from. But as Sean said, not all countries are the same. They are different. There are a few countries, a lot of countries that are in the 6% club that are growing at more than 6% of GDP per annum, 5% at least. You know, so to that, most of those countries are borrowing at probably 7%, between 5.5% or 7% per annum from the market. So the gap between growth and the interest rate is not so bad. It's not so bad at all. Now, but the issue, as well as I said, is this issue of fiscal discipline. So the one thing that slows down the process of debt accumulation is the primary surplus. So as long as a country is running a primary surplus, that acts as a brake on the speed of accumulation. So the issue is fiscal discipline. Mm-hmm. So what has happened to fiscal management in Africa is key. So really, that's how you tell whether we're in danger zone or not. If you know, budget deficits are beginning to grow, fiscal discipline is no longer the order of the day for ministers of finance. And I get a sense that we're still concerned about fiscal discipline. Certainly I am. I'm running a primary surplus, right, mm-hmm. for the last 4 months. So I'm concerned about that. And we are paying our domestic debt. In the last 2 months, we've paid $195 million. Last year, we paid $1.6 billion. And we're running a primary surplus. So it's going the right way in terms of stopping the debt accumulation process upwards. So just those 3 points are key. And I say it at the beginning that this time is different. Yeah. Because the last time, just before the HPIC exercise, countries in Africa were growing at an average rate of 3% per annum. Mm-hmm. They couldn't service concessionary loans, not even commercial, mm-hmm. concessionary loans. Mm-hmm. This time they can service concessional loans, only that they just have too much commercial loans mm-hmm. for which they're paying average interest rates of 7%. And for those growing below the 7%, then they're in trouble. Mm-hmm. So that's really my take on debt. And then 32nd on Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe's issue has been, a balance of payments crisis in the main, but we don't have an excessive debt accumulation. In fact, our debt to equity ratio, I'm an old finance guy. So debt to GDP ratio is 53%, which is manageable, mm-hmm. absolutely manageable by any standards. The issue is that, you know, with balance of payment challenges, but we have a roadmap to clear our arrears. You're right that the staff monitored program is the first step. Mm-hmm. It is the only door through arrears clearance, frankly. And then we have to clear the AFDB and then the World Bank in terms of what we owe them. They're preferred creditors, so we have to clear them first. Once we do that, then that opens credit lines. We lost about 80 different credit lines into our banking sector just because we're in arrears with the AFDB and the World Bank. Once we're done that, we then move on to phase two, which is really the Paris Club partners with whom we have to negotiate and see what deal we can get to restructure that kind of debt. So we have a roadmap, we have a clear path, but we're acutely aware that fiscal discipline at the end of the day is the mm-hmm. key to managing our debt accumulation process. Thank you.
Now that's actually an important point. And I think if you look at that primary balance data for Africa, at least, looks like there was, at least for the median country, they were in surpluses until at least around 2008-09.
Exactly.
And then it flipped into deficit.
Exactly.
And after the 2014 terms of trade shock,
yes.
that deficit widens even further.
Exactly.
Mirroring a bit the trajectory of the run-up.
You're exactly right. So that is the issue.
Okay. Vera, yes. Maybe we'll get you to give us the yes or no answer.
I think the answer is no. Let me pull my head up there and say that The answer is no for a couple of reasons. But why are we having this debt conversation? We're having the debt conversation for three reasons. One, a lot of the countries that are in high risk of debt distress, and the IMF numbers now show us that there's nine countries that are already in high risk of debt distress. Seven. Already in debt distress, and nine are about in high.
Right.
So altogether, 16 countries.
Yeah.
The seven countries are fragile states.
Mm-hmm.
So again, in a fragile state, you don't really have any economic activity. You have, mm-hmm. you know, most of the investments have sort of frozen. So is it a question of debt, or is it just a question of sort of, you know, political conflict, and therefore a lack of better fiscal management? And I think then the problem is not the debt. The mm-hmm. problem is political stability, economic recovery. And so it's not so much a question of debt distress. The countries now that are not in debt distress but are in moderate
mm-hmm.
are a lot of the resource-rich countries. And when you look at the resource-rich countries, we have two problems going on there. Again, it's fiscal.
Yeah.
Half of them, or if not all of them, are countries where they give abundant tax holidays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, as you said, if we decide that we wanted to monetize, you know, and the tax holidays that they are being given to every, you know, gold company that goes into Burkina Faso, and gold prices continue to increase.
Mm-hmm.
So for God's sakes, why are we giving them so many tax holidays? You know, why would Mali continue to give tax holidays when it needs the resources?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's this question of the race to the bottom in our resource-rich countries. Mm-hmm. So you have two problems happening in resource-rich countries. It's one, the tax holidays, which are particularly excessive, and I think that's something that the IMF could start doing for us, is beginning to monetize the cost of tax holidays in these countries and actually put it as a clear budget line.
Budget.
I think that if you begin to bring this kind of transparency to this process, we may not get
mm-hmm.
the problems that we have today. And this is the conundrum. Yes, oil prices have, you know, crashed. But we went from 20 to 40 to 80 to 100. And they're back at 60.
Mm-hmm.
So are you at 60 from 100, or are you at 60 from 20?
Right.
And if you look at it and say that you're at 60 from 20, we should be doing better.
Yeah.
And so then the question is, there is a governance issue in there. And if we can maybe unpack and unwind that governance issue, we may not be in the problem. And hence, I'm now giving the reasons for why I think that we're not in a debt crisis as we were before, but maybe more in a governance crisis. When you look at Nigeria is collecting 7% of non-oil revenue as taxes. It is just not conceivable that that's what's happening. And you look at, I mean, Nigeria essentially collects less revenue than Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at it in that scale, you see something. This is not about, you know, it's again, it's a governance issue. It's not a debt distressed country. And we know with new technology, with digital technology, that you can actually do a lot better. You can do a lot more. Countries, and Sean mentioned South Africa, just in terms of improvements in using technologies, South Africa has been able to improve its revenue collection by 22%. So, and that 22% has essentially gone to abate
mm-hmm.
The debt structuring problem. So I think that that's the first point. The second one is, we are actually seeing investments in infrastructure that is paying off.
Mm-hmm.
And you take a country like Senegal.
Mm-hmm.
Senegal before used to have access to energy. 30% of the population had access to energy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they borrowed, but they actually then increased access to energy from 20-25% to 72%.
Mm-hmm.
They were growing at 2.3, they're growing at 7. Debt distress is a denominator problem.
Mm-hmm.
When you grow at 7%, your debt to GDP ratios drop. So the investments, and I think we can say that in particularly the non-resource intensive countries,
mm-hmm.
investments have been, interestingly, slightly more productive.
Right.
And growth, those are the countries that are growing at our 7-8%, and we see in those countries, no problems with debt distress.
Yeah.
So again, and that's why I think I can comfortably say I don't think that we really are in sort of at risk of a new debt crisis,
mm-hmm.
because what is beginning to happen is those that are getting closer to the edge
mm-hmm.
are beginning to say, you know, what can we do? And Ghana could have been a very sort of, you know, easy case of a country that would have fallen into a debt distress crisis. But two things are happening. Yes, we have a lot of market debt.
Yeah.
But the market is saving us from debt distress, because what the market is doing is penalizing us for bad macro, but it's giving us the resources anyway. So while we are waiting to restructure
mm-hmm.
Ghana can continue going to the market. Yeah. Even if it's not growing at 4.25, it's growing at 7, it's growing at 8. So it's paying higher for management issues, but it's getting some resources that are allowing it to continue to restructure. And you can continue doing this over and over, restructuring. And so we may not have the problem. The reason that we face that in the Gambias is they don't yet have market access. And so they are stuck with coming back to our traditional. But as sort of the markets open up, we will have less and less. Whereas in the first time around, we all had to go to Paris Club because I think today 21 countries have, African countries have access to the markets.
Yep.
So somebody out there will be willing to give you. Mm-hmm. They will penalize you for your bad macro, but they will give you some resources to allow you to live another day. Whereas in the past, we didn't have that. I think the other issue is, and we talked about a little bit about it, is the composition of the debt.
Right.
And when we talk about the question of debt distress, we, of course, talk immediately about external debt, and I'm glad that you talked a little bit about domestic debt. Because part of the problem with the whole debt structure is that if you're stifling your local investors, then it's very difficult to create jobs, it's very difficult to grow, and hence you're shrinking the denominator again. The GDP continues to reduce. And a lot of times when we have the conversations on debt, we always focus on external debt. But it is the private domestic investors that are suffering because their arrears are not being sort of considered. And when we go to countries, that's the first thing we hear. The domestic private sector is telling us, I haven't been paid, the government's in arrears for 5 months, my business is about to close. And so we have this conversation where we sort of focus on the external debt, but we lose focus on the people who are creating the jobs, the people who are generating the growth. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important, again, that we start having that conversation on what is happening in with the domestic sector for two reasons. One, as the public sector gets more debt, they start doing more local borrowing, they crowd out private sector debt, they increase the cost, and that causes, it's not a systemic debt crisis, but it's a private sector employment crisis that we're creating when we do that. And so even though Ghana can continue to go to the market, and Ghana is borrowing internally as well, the private sector in Ghana is shrinking. And that's why we keep asking, why aren't they able to get out? And you go to Ghana, the private sector is shrinking, the domestic private sector in particular, is getting smaller and smaller, jobs are not being created. And I think that is where we're facing the problems. We're not facing a debt crisis problem. We're facing a problem of depressed private investment on the domestic market front that needs to do, where we need to do something. So I think overall, we don't have a sovereign debt crisis. What we should and we need to continue to watch is, of course, this diverse source of new debt. We don't know how to deal with Chinese debt yet. Yeah. We don't know how to deal in the Gambia with GCC, Gulf country debt, and the Gulf countries don't know how to restructure debt. It's not even debt forgiveness. It's just, they haven't in their equations sort of factored in Mauritania is suffering from a debt restructuring problem from the GCC country. So we have, I think, these new pockets that we need to restructure. Mm-hmm. The good thing is we have new pockets that are allowing us to continue borrowing, which is the markets, while we understand how we need to restructure. But I think at some point we need to come back. And the final point on all of that is really about leadership and transparency and efficiency in the investment. Debt is good if, a la Senegal, you're taking debt to build a better road, build a toll road that is going to pay you back, and get more energy that is going to make you more competitive. So debt in itself is a good idea. Nobody can grow without debt. Mm-hmm. The issue is, what is the efficiency of that debt? And what is the use for that debt?
Yeah, no, I think the point particularly about the domestic debt, you're right. It seemed, at least from my vantage point, we've got a bit lost in the discussion, and there's been a lot of focus on external debt. But if you look at the run-up in debt, it looks as if both domestic and external equally contributed to the run-up for the median African country. So you've touched earlier on the market, so which segues well into... to Trang. So you come in this from the private markets perspective, there's a lot of discussion about perhaps impending debt crisis, yet countries are able to issue and it gets oversubscribed. We saw Ghana come on the market, the issue was oversubscribed, we saw Benin come in and do. So is the market really dismissing this concern, or are they being complacent?
So I would certainly say that markets are not dismissing the concerns. Let me take a step back and talk about emerging markets as a whole and how investors are seeing the buildup of risks. So after the financial crisis, there has been a buildup of debt levels, and this applies to government debt and private sector debt as well. And I would say we're at a crossroads where there is a potential collision course between rising debt levels, higher debt burden, and tightening financial conditions. And this is extremely applicable to sub-Saharan Africa as a region because over the past 10 years, we've seen a proliferation of debut issuers from the region, and many of them have never faced a bond maturity before. So there's certainly a degree of nervousness among investors. And when I look at the term debt crisis as it pertains to what I do in my job and as I talk to my investors, it's about repayment capacity. So should we be concerned? Let me give you a few factoids to kind of consider here. So we've had 10 debut issuers since the financial crisis. The debt stock of Eurobonds of the region now stands at around $50 billion. And Sub-Saharan Africa belongs in bond indices. So at JP Morgan, we manage the MB suite of indices. MB stands for Emerging Market Bond Index. And there's roughly $370 billion benchmarked to the MB family of indices. So given that Sub-Saharan Africa is in the benchmark, it's certainly a region that is not ignored by emerging market investors. And if you look at the profile of maturities over the next few years, it's only going to keep rising. With that said, I'd say that the inclusion of Sub-Saharan Africa in bond indices has been a move that is welcomed by investors. If you look at the yield profile, Sub-Saharan Africa on average offers a pickup of over 200 basis points versus the average EM bond. So certainly there is the appetite for carry, appetite for yield has driven investors' motivation to buy the bonds issued by the region. So, you know, like you said, the bond issues have been oversubscribed, and Ghana was able to do that as well, even though a few months before that, comments about the desire to issue a $50 billion century bond really did spook the market. But are we looking at a crisis? I'd say it really depends on the profile of liabilities coming due. Now, if you look at the coupons and maturities coming due for the region, the years where it really starts to pick up is going to be 2022 and beyond. So for the next few years...
In three years,
correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the next few years, it's mainly going to be coupons, which I think are more manageable. Mm-hmm. But investors are closely monitoring governance. Fiscal responsibility, themes which my fellow panelists have all discussed here. So are we looking at an imminent crisis? I would say not, but certainly the risks are building up. And I think it's also important for the issuers, the authorities, to be very mindful of the role of benchmark investing as well, because Sub-Saharan Africa is going to be quite vulnerable to any bouts of risk aversion to the extent that we have tighter financial conditions, that demand for higher yielding debt for riskier assets does decline. There's a good chance that we may see capital being pulled out of emerging markets, and that will affect the region as a whole, and the selling could occur in a very indiscriminate manner.
I think it's the Gulf countries.
So that's actually interesting. So I think it gets a bit at the... changes maybe in the structure of the debt now to have in it more higher share of the markets, market level debt. And the question might then be whether, say, the African countries, as they take advantage of these new sources of financing, are also prepared to deal with the risks that those new instruments kind of bring. So perhaps then I can ask Sean, in terms of the debt management frameworks that the low-income countries, including in Africa, are using, have they adjusted now to reflect say, the new structure of the debt now, particularly the higher private sector debt?
Obviously, it varies obviously with sort of the level of skill and capacity, institutional capacity of governments, and that varies widely. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously, if only for the differences in income levels within the region. I think a lesson I think we have learned is the extent to which the quality of debt monitoring and is actually quite poor. Mm-hmm. We have, for about 4 or 5 years, we've had a debt policy where we discriminate between countries that have strong capacity to monitor and those that don't. And despite an awful lot of technical assistance, mm-hmm. the number of those that don't have strong monitoring capacity hasn't changed. So there's something going wrong. Often it's, you know, you build up capacity and then you ask what's happened and you're told she moved to another department. I exaggerate, but it's often highly personalized. But the importance of actually tracking debt, of monitoring it, it's not rocket science in a technical sense, obviously. It's not necessarily politically easy mm-hmm. to cover a range of enterprises. Mm-hmm. But I would think that still remains a big challenge for a lot of countries.
Okay. And then I think the speaking of that, and that as a source of financing, so some may actually push back a bit there on your point earlier, that perhaps in terms of infrastructure financing, whether these types of new debt that's being issued, I think we've seen a lot of 5-10-year bonds. Mm-hmm. It's a good thing now we're beginning to see 30-year bonds, and whether these are really the right kind of instruments to finance the kind of infrastructure that may have a much longer return type profile. So at what point do we begin to say it's being overdone? At what point do we begin to encourage them to even do more? And also, if as part of this, I know you and I have discussed in the past, we've mentioned the importance of the domestic resource mobilization, which I know is part of your agenda. And to what extent the debt situation perhaps could also be a reflection of deficiencies in that space?
No, I think two questions. Is good investment being overdone? It never will be. Mm-hmm. Is the way we are financing it being overdone? I think there clearly is a mismatch between sort of project durations and availability of capital. And what we have seen is, you know, in many of our African countries, when you build an energy plant, it, essentially in any normal market, it's a 30-year financing investment, but we get it at 10 because of, yes, we are in the EMBA index, but we are not yet sufficiently, we're not AAA yet. Mm-hmm. So as long as you're not AAA, you're not getting the loan maturity that you need, which is the 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that, and remember, we came from five, which mm-hmm. one of the reasons we never had enough energy was no private investor wanted to come and invest in the country where sort of the cycles were 3 years, the coupons were too expensive. Mm-hmm. We've gone to 10, and now, you know, Cote d'Ivoire and the rest are getting at 15 and 30. Mm-hmm. And so definitely we need that. But I think one way of demonstrating that, and it's something that we're doing at the Economic Commission for Africa, is we're working now with local pension funds. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of because it's essentially the conversation is about investments and savings and where can we garner more savings. Debt is, you know, we're getting savings from the rest of the world into Africa. We are not looking at African savings. And when you look at African savings, we're just doing some work now with Kenya and trying to pull together what we're calling a pension consortium. Mm-hmm. We were able to put together $20 billion worth of pension funds. This is dormant capital that immediately gives you 30-year money. And so what we're doing is now working with U.S. pension funds, the Philadelphia Teachers Association, New York Teachers Association, and saying, come in and pair yourselves with this, you know, local long-term capital mm-hmm. and take joint risk. And investors are actually much more happy to come in when they see that, you know, the local, the country has skin in the game. Mm-hmm. So we're beginning to do that, and we're hoping that we can sort of expand this program across the continent. And there, you know, there's this conversation about Africa doesn't have enough savings. Yeah. We have quite an amount of savings, mm-hmm. but we just don't have it in an organized, cultured vehicles. Another thing that we're looking at is securitization of a couple mm-hmm. of assets mm-hmm. around the country where, you know, we're beginning to do an experiment with gas bottles. Mm-hmm. If you just think about it, you know, in most of our African countries, when you go to buy a gas bottle, you put down a security deposit. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever thinks about what you do with that security deposit. In one of the countries that we are working in, that security deposit is $1 billion. Wow. So if you just imagine what you can now do with the securitized lending, how you can then translate that into investment and use that to do a lot more things, we will not have to have, you know, lending for sort of risk-adjusted rate of return positive assets put on government books that are causing the question of debt crisis. So I think there's a huge range of innovative financing that we're now looking at, and that when we start bringing those on board on the continent, will totally change the discussion about, you know, is there a high risk of debt distress. And that is why I think, actually, that as we do that and as we do more innovative financing, we will probably be able to move backwards.
But just a hot pursuit to what Vera is saying, the earlier point about infrastructure bonds and the duration matching in terms of the projects, most of this doesn't have to sit on government books at all.
Exactly.
It could just be a BOT project for a road or power station or whatever. And then it's a 30-year concession, and try to match that with a 30-year infrastructure bond sitting on the balance sheet of this of the SPV, not on government. Government could maybe offer a guarantee or something, but they shouldn't.
Otherwise, then it's 100%
so, debt. So I don't think that the idea of infrastructure bond should necessarily burden the government. It could just be a BOT, and it's completely off balance sheet.
No, and actually, I was looking at some numbers from the in a report of the African Development Bank. It actually showed that over between 2012 and 2016, if you look at infrastructure financing, 40% of it came from the government. Mm. And you look at a multilateral development bank, it was 3%. And you look at the private sector, it's like at 6%.
Yeah.
And then I think China was at 15%. So there's clearly scope there for, say, MDBs to come in, as well as private sector, to help alleviate the pressure on the government balance sheets.
Public sectors continue to finance infrastructure projects because of the governance issue on land, because a lot of public sector infrastructure projects need land rights, and the private sector does not want to deal with the land rights. I think that if the public sector were able to take off the land issues on roads, on trains, even on energy, you need to secure the land before you do the investment. And so you do need some public investment. And I think even in the United States, public investment remains a big part of infrastructure investing because we want to make sure that, as speaking as a UN, with my UN hat, that we leave no one forgotten or no one behind. So there's always the last mile. And that last mile needs some public resources to blend. But we don't need as much from on the public books.
She mentioned an interesting point about about the risk of capital leaving emerging markets. I wanted to pick up on that. I didn't want to forget that. So I would have thought that this risk would only exist if you think the interest rate cycle is now headed upwards.
Yeah,
I think it's still headed sideways or downwards. So should we be worrying too much? I think we're still safe.
So I would say I'm less worried than I was 3 months ago before the Fed.
You're less worried. Oh, okay.
I'm less worried.
Me too.
because the Federal Reserve has adopted a more dovish stance now. However, what hasn't changed is the fact that quantitative easing is also now declining. So there is less liquidity, less dollar liquidity out there for investors to be buying emerging market bonds.
And I think in this discussion, obviously, there'll be a lot of focus on the level of debt. But one thing that seems different this time versus last time is now, even relatively to the debt forgiveness episode, the level of debt one had seen is, on average or median, is still lower.
Right.
But the cost of debt
is higher. It is.
So that may be alluding indeed here to the more debt contracted on commercial terms. And I looked at Ghana's issuance. It's 10-year.
But it's not just please. The cost of debt. You see, is that gap between the cost of debt and growth is about the gap. That's the issue. What we should do is compare the gap just before he peak and the gap now. That's the issue. And sitting here, to me, it looks like actually the gap this time around is narrower than before. But you're right. In absolute terms, it's costlier debt, but the gap is narrower.
There's also exchange rate movements, right? Ghana goes to the market and borrows 750. The city collapses, and the 750 becomes 1.3 billion. So, and again, this is the question of saying, can we begin to move to more local currency debt? The reason we don't talk about, Sean talks about it, because, and we should all talk about it a little bit more, the South African economy, South Africa, 80% of South Africa's debt is in local currency. Mm. So in some sense, they can absorb those shocks much faster than Ghana. We all talk about Ghana because Ghana is denominated in foreign currency, and every time there is some movement, you know, the Ghanaians should be looking more at Fed movements than anything else because it directly impacts the...
Which gets at the point as to whether the management framework have really incorporated those kind of new market risk, rollover risk, exchange rate risk, and interest rate, shared rate risk. But when you speak of gap earlier, but in the 90s, et cetera, there were not really many African countries, in fact, on the markets. So we didn't have that rate that can allow you to make comparisons, right, between the gap then versus the gap now, or you're thinking of the rates based on the amount of concessional debt they had at the time.
You know, I just mean the gap between GDP growth, export growth, and the cost of debt in the first place. And my argument that I think the gap is narrower now than before, regardless of the fact that it's now more commercial debt, before it was concessionary. So that's what it is.
But I think even seeing like in this low interest rate environment, maybe Trang, you can help us better understand. So the 10-year treasury is maybe around 2.5%. Ghana issuing 10-year, you're looking at 8%. Or more percent, isn't that a huge gap? I mean, is the market really pricing well the risks in Africa? And to what extent is that really contributing to the debt servicing burden you touched earlier about the repayment capacity? So sometimes you looked at the credit ratings given to African countries, and it looks like they're kind of clustered as if it's not doing enough differentiation among the countries and perhaps alluding to some possible risk mispricing.
So I'd say at the high level, I don't think there's enough differentiation among the countries. And this is
in the ratings or in the fundamentals?
In the way that markets price the bonds.
Okay.
I won't speak to rating agencies and how they perform their rating evaluations, but I think from a market standpoint, if you look at the way that sub-Saharan Africa bonds trade, it's usually just a beta function of the market. Mm-hmm. If the market sells off 10 basis points, sub-Saharan Africa will sell off about 20. Mm-hmm. And conversely, if markets are rallying 10 basis points, the region will rally 20 basis points. Mm-hmm. And there's very little differentiation at the country level. And so I think there is, it's reasonable to expect that the market does a bit more homework in differentiating among the countries. But I think the way that emerging market investors and how their mandates are designed is usually very much flow-based. So if they get inflows, they're going to go out there and find all the bonds they can buy. Mm-hmm. And so that usually results in a bit of a lack of differentiation, of what you will, in terms of the pricing. But in terms of the absolute level of pricing as it stands now versus history, you would argue, yes, 8% yield, that sounds like a major pickup. But if you compare where we are now versus the widest level that we saw back in early 2016, we're actually, I'd say we've rallied probably 5% already, 500 basis points in spread. So it is... it does seem like a rather large pickup versus U.S. Treasuries, but we're coming off from double-digit yields already.
So it's getting better, you're saying?
Exactly.
Sean, I don't know if you have any reactions or any comment. Particularly, you touched on the issue of the more diffuse creditor base, and you touched on how, in the case of Chad, it was easy to do that resolution because there was one major creditor. But in Congo's case, it's kind of a bit messy. Is the average median African country looking now more like Congo in terms of debt resolution restructuring, or is it looking more like Chad?
In the case of Congo, it's actually one major creditor again, but it's in contrast to Chad, where the creditor is a commercial company, and where restructuring debts with high-skilled lawyers is part of the business model. In the case of the other, of the Congo, the counterpart is not really has not really internalized doing debt restructuring, would rather do muddled through and, you know, don't worry about it, don't pay us, we'll let the arrears accumulate, mm-hmm. which unfortunately is not the way that you can engage with the IMF and the World Bank. You can't sort of have these kinds of casual understandings. Mm-hmm. So I won't hazard I think that issue of a rich creditor base and a complex one is a difficult one, but let's think of one positive feature. Mm-hmm. And what was so unique to HIPC was not that it was lots of official credits that you had to get restructured. HIPC was all about restructuring multilateral debt.
Okay.
Because, as Amthuli will agree with, in good times, money from the IFIs is great. It's cheap.
Yep.
Once you're into solvency problems, it's an absolute millstone around your neck because you can't restructure it. So to the extent to which the MDB, IFI, IMF debt has shrunk significantly, there's an awful lot of debt that can be restructured. But a thought on Vera's comments about the importance of the domestic market, which has grown substantially.
Yep.
You can't so easily, as we know from European examples, restructuring domestic market debt is a lot more complicated. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's your domestic banking system that's holding the debt, mm-hmm. you're actually also behind the banking system. So a lot of that debt isn't restructurable. Maybe I'm being very cynical, but if you look right through the debt structure, mm-hmm. what can I restructure mm-hmm. if I'm in trouble? Is a very important question to ask.
And then I think that's probably been recognized, and I suspect there are efforts to kind of put in place some debt restructuring mechanism that could reflect this new landscape. What is the state of affairs or progress on that? Or there is none?
I don't want to comment on individual countries, but as I said, if you think of Paris Club members...
Yeah.
The Paris Club is a set of rules built over whatever, 20 years, 25 years. Mm-hmm. Secondly, and perhaps equally importantly, within each Paris Club member, there's a range of institutions that have extended debt. Mm-hmm. But after much institutional fighting, I'm certain, in the 70s and 80s, there's a mechanism whereby the US government approaches the Paris Club, or there's a mechanism whereby the German government approaches the Paris Club. Mm-hmm. There's not a mechanism whereby some major emerging market creditors have a uniformed way of forming a position across major institutions in the economy. Mm-hmm. And that isn't something you can talk about how important it is, mm-hmm. but you don't move large countries' institutions quickly.
Yeah. Okay. So one subject we touched on but only briefly was China. And it's hard to talk about debt in Africa without China coming up. So how big a deal is really... China as a source of Africa's debt and Africa's debt problems. Is it a myth or is it really an area of concern? And this is for anyone on the panel.
Well, I think that in contracting Chinese debt, you just have to subject it to the normal debt rigorous analysis that you do. It can't be outside the normal sovereign debt management process. So you have to subject it to that. So it really comes back to the capacity to manage debt in the first place, the strength of the debt management offices or units within treasuries, wherever they sit. So it shouldn't be outside that. You should just subject it to that. So if I look at Zimbabwe right now, we don't have an issue with the Chinese debt. On the contrary, it's a non-Chinese debt which is the issue. So that's not our problem. But I think that at the end of the day, it's about the quality of debt management, and mm-hmm. that's what we should subject it to that. Some of the debt has been contracted for infrastructure mm-hmm. development, which is a good thing because you need deep pockets to develop some of the infrastructure. But things to watch out for, obviously, is when there's a pronouncement that this I've come across, mm-hmm. that this a specific project is a PPP, it's a BOT, and then a Treasury Department is then asked to extend a guarantee, which I mentioned earlier. Then you must know it's not a BOT. Extending a guarantee, you're still exposed. So that contingent liability you must always watch out for. Mm-hmm. But I must say that I wouldn't single out Chinese debt as an issue, but rather all debt should be subjected to the normal debt management process and shouldn't be outside that.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
Chinese debt is 20% of our sub-Saharan Africa's total external debt.
Mm-hmm.
So 20%. Mm-hmm. So in some sense, it's not the sort of big elephant in the room. I think that because, and in a very sort of roundabout way, there is a little bit of a negative on Chinese debt because the Chinese are not transparent about the numbers. Mm-hmm. And I think that the more we begin to get a sense, and in China came into the OECD and just sort of did the kind of debt reporting that everybody else did, then you will get, I think, some better information around Chinese debt. But I think there are, just like we saw in Mozambique, where, you know, nice reputable banks out of London and Paris, you know, do $2 billion worth of, you know, essentially very interesting structuring. There are, of course, you know, occasional Chinese debt that are equivalent to the, you know, fashionable London banks debt deals. But that is where transparency becomes important.
Right, exactly.
Because once you have the right governance structures and the right transparency processes, then whether it's commercial debt or it's Chinese debt or even concessional debt, because part of the big HIPIC process was a lot of white elephants that were not giving the development outcomes that you needed. So the quick answer is no. Chinese debt is not any different from the Eurobond debt or from some of the bilateral debt that we're contracting from other sources. I think the question is, again, public investment management, is that debt contracted for the right kinds of investment? If you contract debt to build boxing stadiums, the probability that you're going to be able to pay back is much less than if you contracted debt to build an energy plant or a water system or something that had a rate of return that was higher.
That emphasizes really the question of the governance.
That's right.
Around it, and but also, both sides. And then coming again, staying with this, the Chinese debt, and you mentioned earlier some innovative financing mechanism. So we're also seeing some commodity-linked debt that is coming on board. You know, China being at the a major counterparty to that, but obviously there's, I think, also private multinational like Glencore. Etc. Is it your sense that governance-wise, these deals are structured in the best way possible that best serves Africa's interests and the creditors' interests, or balances well those two interests?
Well, our experience in Zimbabwe and what I've seen in other countries is that is some of the debt is commodity-linked, and it's not necessarily all Chinese debt. In fact, we have more non-Chinese debt that is commodity-linked in Zimbabwe than Chinese debt. Linked to gold output, to platinum output, to diamond output, because also you need to structure it. In fact, it feels like trade finance at the end of the day. You need to do that so that you are sure that you can service, you can escrow the profits from the exports to service the debt. So that's okay. But those commodities don't necessarily have to be delivered to China or to the country where the money is being sourced. It's just to be sure that the debt can be serviced in the first place. For instance, but we don't have actually a specific structure that says you will sell a specific commodity to China or to a specific country. We don't. To us, it's just a way to escrow and to ensure that we can service the debt. My last conversation with the key institutions that get involved with these debt structures from China, which is China Exim Bank and Sinoshore, is that you know, when we think we should be worrying about being exposed to Chinese debt, they too are about worried about their exposure to Africa, you know, and they're saying that, hey, we are also watching our exposure to African countries to make sure that we're not overly exposed. So they too are worried about that, and that's good, that if they worry about it, then Africa knows that it won't be overborrowed from China. So we need both sides to think like that, and that's a good thing. Right. I think we're moving to healthier and healthier, you know, positions every time with China.
Okay.
And commodity-linked debt just is not an Africa invention. A lot of Latin America grew, and I'm sure Rian can tell us about that. On commodity, actually, part of, I think, the problem in some of our resource-rich countries is that we have not structured well our commodity-linked debt. We should probably do more. It'll take off the debt from the balance sheets of the state because you just do it with the investors.
Exactly.
And you can smooth out the debt. So there is actually, I think sometimes when we say it like that, it looks like it's a bad thing. But it's a bad thing because it's done in a bad governance environment.
Right, exactly.
If you do it and structure it well, it actually takes away from the fiscal space on the government side, and it creates a much smoother a financing environment for both the investor and the investee.
Yeah, absolutely. So before I turn to the audience, I think they're eager to jump in the conversation. Perhaps one question to Nthule. So you've been on this on the side of those giving advice to government. Now you've crossed over. You are now really like a policymaker as you implement policy as opposed to dispensing policy advice like perhaps the rest of us. What have you learned in terms of some of the recommendation we're even giving policymakers to do? And is it sufficiently taking into account some other political economy dimensions of following up on some of these recommendations we know to be good but may not be practical? Or you haven't been there long enough to run into that issue?
I have. A day is always a long time in Zimbabwe. So I have run into that already. No, you're quite right that every reform agenda, every policy has some political economy issue to deal with, without question. There are winners and losers. Mm-hmm. You have those who have something to gain as well. So it's like that. I think I found, the most difficult, issue has been, to be fair, currency reform. I think has been the most difficult of issues to deal with, because you're trying to reform a currency system in a situation where you don't have enough balance of payment support. Yeah. You don't have a funded program under the IMF, or indeed you can't access capital markets as easily as you could before. Mm-hmm. So that there's always a challenge in that sense. On the fiscal front, I think it's not been easy, but it's just less difficult, I think. Mm-hmm. Also, it's because we took the kind of easier route first, which was to expand the tax base through our electronic transactions tax. Mm-hmm. So that gave us a bit of breathing space to allow us then to look more seriously at the cost containment, the cost-cutting aspects of it. I think an area that will always be not easy because there's also a history. It is around, how to support the agricultural sector. You are doing it during a moment when we have got El Nino on one hand, so you have a genuine contraction in the sector, and then you have a cyclone after that. It's a very tough place to be at if you're trying to support agriculture, but. We're trying to improve our productivity upwards. We even have to pay some debt to the farmers who were displaced in the year 2000, 2001. We're going to do it. We're going to conclude that this year. So it's a sector that is obviously has a lot of, we call it political economy and politics around it. And it's understood. It's always an emotive sector. Around the mining sector, there are no big issues around the mining sector. It's one of the biggest beneficiaries and industry as well. But the other politics is really geopolitics, that you do find yourself exposed to geopolitics as well. I won't mention, as the government says, don't mention countries, but I think we have some countries where we don't have as easy a conversation. And for some countries, we have an easier conversation. Not have an easy conversation, but you still owe their money as well. So how do you get that conversation going? So there is that geopolitics, internal political economy, and as a Minister of Finance, you have to appreciate how complex it is. Right. In fact, you need to appreciate complexity for you to understand the job. If you get it around your head that this is a complex job, then you sleep well at night. You can put all the pieces together, be able to act, and that's what I try to do.
All right, wonderful. And we do hope you get some good night's sleep. So now we can turn over to our audience, and we'll take three questions at a time. And please raise your hand. Mics are going to come around. State your name as well as your affiliation. And I'd like to ask you to please keep the questions or comments really brief so we can get in as many as possible in the remaining time. Yes.
Thank you. Barry Wood from MoneyWeb and BizNews in South Africa. For Minister Nkube, your situation in debt seems unique because you're in arrears to the bank, and as you say, you can't access markets. How are you going to pay off the World Bank and the other creditors when you're not able to get IMF money because of U.S. sanctions, et cetera? It seems like this is... You speak of a roadmap, but what's the roadmap given what I've just said?
Thank you very much for that question. For us, that is the issue that we need to deal with in terms of dealing with our arrears. So the it's a three-step procedure. One, we had to produce a credible economic and political reform agenda. We've done that. It's called the Transitional Stabilization Program. It runs from October 2018. I launched it on the 4th of October. And then also in Bali, at the annual meeting of the World Bank and IMF in Bali, Indonesia, on the, I think it was 7th of October or something. And then that's the first step. So that was accepted. And then the second step now is to get onto the staff monitored program with the IMF. And we have done that. So that's what the IMF announced a few days ago. So we tick that box. That's the second step. Because the only door through arrears clearance for Zimbabwe is through the SNP program. There's no other door. There's just no other door. That is the only door. And number three is then to see how we can work with the G7 countries for a bridge loan, because we are short of about $1 billion in terms of combining the World Bank and the AFDB, because they rank pari passu. You have to, if you want to clear one, you have to clear the other. The pari passu rule is hard, it's not a soft one. So that's what we're looking at now, is concessionary funding to be able to close that gap. Short bridge loan, which will then allow us to access whatever soft resources there are in those two institutions, and then we're able to clear the areas and open up the gates to more capital for our banking sector. Then we'll move on to stage four, which is basically the bilateral, now the Paris Club. But it also turns out that the those who control the World Bank and the FDB is the same bilateral credit partners who sit on the Paris Club round table. So we're talking to the same people, but we're quickly aware that at that stage, we also need one or two champions who can champion for our case. I think we've found 2.5 so far. But I can't name them. I'm not allowed to name them. Well, we're looking good in terms of champions. So I hope that we get there. But we have just to walk the talk on delivering on the targets for the S&P, and then we start serious negotiations for the IFIs, the preferred creditors, and then eventually the Paris Club partners. So we can see a clear path for Arias' clearance agenda.
Okay, so we'll take three questions at a time before we turn it over to the panelists. Yes, ma'am.
Hello, I'm Deborah Brautigam, the director of the China-Africa Research Initiative at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, SAIS, next door. Thank you all. This is a really great presentation, full of wonderful information. I often tell the anecdote about commodity-linked lending, about Japan providing a $10 billion line of credit to China in 1978 mm-hmm. that China repaid, or if it had all been carried out, by coal and oil.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This has certainly, for China, been going on for a long time and a model that they learned long ago. My question is for mainly for Sean, but also for Minister Nkube. The commodity-linked debt has always been a problem for the World Bank and the IMF because they're preferred creditors. So if you have commodity-linked debt, then that's basically going out and repaying a different lender before you. And so I wonder how you guys are dealing with that now. And the second question is related to that. 10 years ago, or actually more than 10 years ago now, when the Chinese first kind of started to hit the headlines as big actors in Africa, there was a lot of concern on the Chinese side with the debt sustainability analysis that you guys had. And Li Ruogyu, who was at that time the head of the China Exim Bank, argued for a development sustainability analysis instead of your DSA. And I wonder what your thinking is now. And Professor or Minister Nkube, I'm curious what you think about that as well, and Ms. Songwei as well, because you were also stating how Chinese lending is basically building development and infrastructure. So thank you.
Okay, we'll take one more question. The lady in the back.
Thanks. Good afternoon. My name is Amma Bedu-Forsen. I'm a senior Africa economist at IHS Markit. And I had two questions, but I will just ask one. We've talked a lot about the need as part of improving debt sustainability for governments to consider ways to take debt off their balance sheets. And I wanted to ask your views on how best to improve investor perceptions as they go into do investments in particular projects, especially since with a number of investors, they're typically looking for government guarantees for certain projects as a way to mitigate the risk. That's been at least my experience with certain clients. So just your views on ways to help in that regard, helping investors to have a more confident understanding or a more comprehensive understanding of risk such that they are willing to consider going into projects and having partners and not necessarily looking for those government guarantees that would impact the debt profile of governments. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So on the investment risk participation, you want to go ahead first? How do you improve that perception?
So I'd say the hurdle is quite high for a traditional EM investor to go into a deal without understanding without a high confidence of a government guarantee. I think we're probably, the asset class is still, especially for the region, Sub-Saharan Africa as a region, is still fairly new compared to some of the more mature emerging markets. Mm-hmm. So I think to, say, issue a bond through an SPV, it's probably the equivalent of the government issuing a bond. So I don't, at the moment, it's hard for me to really make that distinction, speaking from an investor standpoint. Mm-hmm. And in our MB index, we include all bonds issued by quasi-sovereigns, so entities that are 100% owned by the government. So they're one and the same in the eyes of the investor.
Mm-hmm. And for the earlier couple of questions on China, any of the panelists want to go?
I'll have a first go. I'll answer Deborah's questions by reference to Angola to make it concrete. And in a sense, post-2000, after the Civil War, Angola could only really access any external capital through collateralized lending, in the sense of being collateralized with the oil receipts that were going into the escrow accounts offshore. And this poses a big problem, or did, for the World Bank because of the negative pledge clause. It doesn't quite pose as big a problem for the fund, which doesn't quite have a very clear view on collateralization. But if I was to take it forward to today, where there is an IMF lending program with Angola, one of the features of that, Angola now is a much richer creditor base than it had then. One of the features of the program is actually the gradual scaling back and scaling down of no new collateralized lending. In a sense, it made sense in 2002 when you couldn't get money from anybody, but it's far more problematic in an environment where you have a range of creditors because, of course, you start benefiting one creditor at the expense of the others, and if you do it covertly and then it becomes known, then you're in deep trouble. Mantui.
Sustainability versus development sustainability. Yes, it's a very interesting question. But really the way forward is you can reconcile those two through PPPs. That's our view. If I'll give you an example, so we've got this big project that we're doing with Zambia on the Zambezi River, which is the Batoka Gorge, $5.2 billion that will require. And we're going to concession it out. If I can say this, because this is not public information, that the preferred bidders is one is an American company, the other is a Chinese company, and that's good in terms of the way it looks as well. But so because it's a PPP, we are going to get some development out of it. But also, is debt sustainable because it's not sitting on the balance sheets of either the Zambian or the Zimbabwe government. So it's possible to achieve both if it is structured properly. And in fact, that's a project that initially, before we came in, was going to be sitting on the government's balance sheet, and we changed everything on the 7th of December last year. So I think PPPs are the way to go, BOT specifically, to dealing with this balance between debt sustainability and development sustainability, regardless of who's financing, the Chinese or whoever, regardless. That's really the way we think we should go. The question perhaps about improving the investor perception, which was asked by someone right at the back, we have a specific transaction right now where we are looking at extending a government guarantee to improve the credit standing of the project. But also, government is going to seek a counter guarantee from an international bank against our guarantee. And the rating of this bank is higher than that of the Zimbabwe government. So that's how we've been dealing with it. So counter guarantees from an international bank to supplant the guarantee that we're offering and move up the credit standing to a higher level. Thank you.
I think on that question as well, we can do the instruments, but the bottom line is African countries just have to start getting better at improving the business environment. Mm-hmm. And as long as you do not improve the business environment, I think, yes, there is maybe some pricing in that is, you know, just the risk perception of the continent is not so good. But as long as two-thirds of the continent is on the bottom third of the, you know, doing business index, it's not going to work. So I think there is a policy decision that needs to be made. And where you have the combination of the good policy decision and a repeater of private investment, and we have, I think, now a litany of countries that have done IPPs in the energy sector. Mm-hmm. So much so that, you know, the energy companies no longer are looking for a guarantee.
No.
They're just willing to go and do the third project because they know that there's a bankable and that the government contracts are secure and they can go on with business. Mm-hmm. But in those first countries where it's taking, you know, 8 years to get to closure and you have to negotiate every, then they will persist on needing a guarantee. So there's countries now on the continent where guarantees for the energy sector are no longer required. And in Nigeria, we are no longer talking about guarantees for many of the investments that are going in. So I think as we do that in Senegal, I think Zambia now is going on its second one and is doing well on the PPP side. So I think we need countries to start closing those deals, closing them in a time frame that is acceptable. And then particularly for the infrastructure deals, you need the SOEs that are bankable. And that is a governance issue again. It's, you know, do we have the right regulatory environment for the energy sector so that the government doesn't wake up in the morning and decide what the price is? That's why we're taking, because I think we need to ask the question, why do people need the guarantee? You need the guarantee for political risk. You need the guarantee for policy risk. And so as you take away those things, then the sort of decision for a guarantee begins to drop. And I think the fixation on, oh, there is a guarantee is maybe a little bit of a cop-out for our governments, because then it doesn't say we're doing it because policy is no good. And so it's not just a guarantee. It's a policy guarantee. It's a guarantee because policy may change. It's a guarantee because the political situation may change. And if we take away those things, then we don't need the guarantee.
That's right. But also you could go to the markets. Before I became minister, I worked on a transaction 2 years ago where we managed to source and help this company, which will remain unmentioned, you know, source a guarantee basically from the Lloyd's insurance market. So just simple insurance from the Lloyd's insurance market was enough to improve the credit standing of this transaction so much so that it was so much easier to raise capital. But you have to pay for the premium. There's no free lunch here.
Yes, Sean.
Just maybe to sound a sort of a, not a dissenting note, but a cautionary note. I mean, the issue in, say, PPPs, for example, is the devil's in the details. And the issue is usually, are your lawyers smarter and better paid than theirs?
Oh, yeah.
And the answer often is no, in which case the devil is really in the details. It's truly the devil that's in the details, I should be saying, actually, rather than the generic statement. And so I think Vera gives an excellent example in the energy sector where once things get standardized and PPPs get standardized, the government can see exactly what kind of risk it is incurring and what it's not incurring. But the starting point has to be one of really teasing out exactly what, as Mtuli says, it's off your balance sheet to an extent, but there's guarantees floating around, mm-hmm. and you really need to know exactly which ones there are and how they kick in. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, that, as I said, it's important to really look at them, particularly in the early stages of developing PPP structures.
Okay, wonderful. So on that note, we're at the end of the event. But I'd like to give the opportunity to the panelists to give perhaps a one-minute closing remark. And in that process, try to tell us what is really the one thing African countries can do and the one thing Africa's partners can do to make sure that Africa avoids another systemic debt crisis.
All right. So I'd say there is a general desire to see better data so the investor community can just do their homework on the region. And I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm going to give a second piece of advice also to the countries. And I alluded to this earlier, but I think it's critically important to understand your investor base. And so understanding the role of benchmark investing and having an active dialogue with the sell-side banks who own the indices. And in this case, the emerging market bond indices are largely owned by JP Morgan. So having that active dialogue between the finance ministries and with JP Morgan, understanding the rules around indexing, when a bond goes in and out, and understanding investor behavior, I think it's critically important.
Yeah, thank you. Vera?
I think two things. One, on the countryside, is the cost of the debt is really a reflection of your policy environment. Mm-hmm. So good policies mean cheaper debt. So the message to countries is, please, we know how to do it now. Mm-hmm. We have demonstrated, I think, from 2000 to 2012 that, mm-hmm. Most of our finance ministers, our governments understand what good macro sustainability looks like and how it can be done. Mm-hmm. We have new tools and techniques that can improve revenue collection. Mm-hmm. I think that many more of our countries have good public investment management agencies. So really, let's focus on the policy side and fix that. I think what to tell our other partners, it's really a message to our colleagues. It's on sort of how we account for the debt and the SOEs, and I think Sean Elizabeth alluded to the things that are outside that got come inside when we start looking at these numbers. I think there is maybe a conversation that we need to rehave on SOEs, and that I think in 2000 when Africa Rising happened, we forgot a little bit the SOE of sector of the economy, and we didn't look at it enough. And some countries are waking up and finding that they're in debt crisis because the SOEs are coming back in and mm-hmm. the IMF is bringing them back in and didn't used to bring them back in. So there has been a little bit of a shift in sort of what is the universe that we're putting in. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good shift because we've brought it back in so we can push the discipline. But I think then if we bring it back in, we should stay in and then let's make sure that we begin to account for it. I still think that, the sort of guarantee 100% transfer into the debt numbers, maybe it's a bit too much, and that we may want to start looking at, is that really penalizing countries when you go out there to get a guarantee? Because you're already being penalized by the private sector when they ask you for a guarantee.
Right.
Now, if the IMF penalizes you even more by computing that as 100% debt when in actuality it's not,
there's a balance.
I think, a little bit of a sort of closing in of the space for countries, and maybe there is a conversation that we can have.
Oh, very good.
For me, it's perhaps it's two things. One is just to make sure that we, in countries, we strengthen debt management capacity mm-hmm. and the quality of the data for the sovereign as well as the sub-sovereign, which is the parts that rules, making sure that we understand the data, we understand the debt profile with the right skills mm-hmm. for managing this data, and also understanding that debt management is also a dynamic process.
Right.
That you cannot say we have a rule that public debt should be more than 7% of GDP, mm-hmm. but rather it's a dynamic process driven by different variables in the market right. and also both globally and locally. So that is very critical. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I think that we need to move more and more towards a government balance sheet approach mm-hmm. to managing the fiscus, which is we always talk about government having debt. But who talks about government assets? The assets we talk about is SOE ownership. Mm-hmm. But government has buildings, has other things. So just thinking through this idea of a kind of sovereign wealth fund, if I can use that, mm-hmm. but a balance sheet approach to fiscal management is key, then we can. For some of these countries that are so-called indebted, you may actually find that if they thought careful about the value of their assets, land, including government offices, you know, government vehicles, whatever, mm-hmm. they find that the assets probably outstrip in value the mm-hmm. debt that they owe, at least domestic debt for a start. Mm-hmm. So that kind of thinking is critical, and I think our partners must help us along to think that way. I know that mm-hmm. there's a moment in the IMF was really pushing this. I hear less noise now, maybe, but any help we can get. Certainly Zimbabwe, that's what we're looking at. We're actually looking at that to try to understand the value of all our assets vis-a-vis our liabilities, because that's the key to... And when you do that, by the way, then you have a kind of sovereign wealth fund type structure. You can then even improve your credit standing, because suddenly you've got a portfolio that is worth something, you know?
If you can make it liquid soon enough.
That's it. The thing that once you do that, I think literally of a Temasek, and I'll use that as an example, you have to actively manage it. You have to put it in the hand of professionals. That's how you get the liquidity going when you have professionals managing this thing.
Okay. Actually, as an aside there, in the last year, the IMF's fiscal monitors looked at the whole issue of how effectively public assets are used rather than preoccupation with the liability side, because, of course, it's huge.
Right. That's right.
The scope for raising returns on that effective management are also really high. But to answer your two questions, they echo what others have said. Mm-hmm. From the point of view of countries, I think the most important thing is unified, transparent control of the contracting of debt. Mm-hmm. It has to be signed off on, but ideally by Parliament, definitely by the Finance Minister. Mm-hmm. Nothing else should be contracted without that framework. Otherwise, you're lost almost to governance problems.
And there are guidelines for that provided by the IMF, World Bank.
Yeah. There are a range of guidelines, but that idea of centralised control mm-hmm. is really and parliamentary oversight is crucial. Right. And I think from the partners' perspective, I think actually it is incumbent upon the IMF and the World Bank to, not in a hysterical fashion, but to engage actively in conversations with government on debt levels. Mm-hmm. And I think the other angle that's really important is the prioritisation and choice of public investments. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, an area where development partners can actually contribute in terms of technical assistance and competence. Mm-hmm. To choose a slightly facetious example, I think if you use the location of the African Cup of Nations as a predictor of significant jump in debt, it's really good. And that's the Russians can afford to build a zillion stadiums that don't generate revenue at all, but when you're a poor country, it's not necessarily an efficient use of funds. So that hard-headed approach to choosing investments based on their development potential, I think, is really important.
Okay, excellent. So on this note, please really join me in thanking the panel for this excellent discussion.